straight person. Oh, well. I will have to forego that. I just eat anyway. Did you get a chance to go out and eat?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to Subway.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
So where's
okay. Scoot on through. Let's see what's on the agenda.
Is it better?
Okay.
Yeah,
right here. Save time.
Evening. Senate Judiciary Committee will return to order from our recess. We're going to make a slight change in the agenda here. Senator Eakin needs to move on quickly to something else, so we're going to take his bill. It should be short, he promises. Senate File 459. Senator Eakin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 459, this is its third committee that it's being heard in, and I would ask that the Senate File 459 be moved and recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor if one of your members could do so.
Why don't you go ahead and explain the bill, and then we'll consider it.
Sure. The Senate File 459 is the Department of Human Services bill comprised of policy changes for the continuing care area of the department, covering long-term care policy. The section of relevance to this committee is Section 15. Section 15 requires, and you'll find that on page 28 of the bill. This section requires county adult protection units to use a validated, structured decision-making tool to carry out tasks mandated by current law regarding maltreatment of vulnerable adults. So it's providing a uniform system that all counties would use. And Rachel Sands is here from the Department of Human Services, and she'll provide a summary of the change in Section 15.
Sands, welcome to the committee. And also, while you're at it, we have in our notes that Section 4, Subdivision 2, is also under consideration by this committee. So I mean, that's just one sentence change, but we'll need to look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rachel Shands. As Senator Eakin said, I'm with the Department of Human Services, Aging and Adult Services Division. So I will start my testimony with Section 15, and then we can turn our attention to the other section that you mentioned. As Senator Eakin said, Section 15 of this bill requires all county adult protection units to use this validated, structured decision-making tool in order to carry out work that is currently mandated by state law. When a county receives a potential report about potential maltreatment of a vulnerable adult who lives in the community, county adult protection units are responsible to investigate this report. Counties also provide necessary protective services to vulnerable adults who have been subject to maltreatment. A vulnerable adult is a person over the age of 18 who, because of physical or mental disability or due to a dependency on services, is vulnerable to maltreatment. So in 2009, six Minnesota counties collaborated with the National Council on Crime and Delinquency to develop a structured decision-making tool for use by adult protection staff. The counties involved in this effort were Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Steele, and Washington counties. Research supports the conclusion that for complex decisions, structured frameworks result in more reliable and accurate decisions than clinical judgment alone, even for highly skilled professionals. The structured decision-making tool is designed to reinforce the clinical judgment of adult protection workers along critical decision points of the assessment and investigative process. For example, after a county receives a report, the professionals must determine whether or not the adult that is subject of the report meets the definition of a vulnerable adult, and they also must determine whether the alleged action rises to the level of maltreatment, meaning abuse, neglect, or exploitation. So the tool guides professionals through key decision points and requires documentation and rationale for the worker's decision, which results in more reliable, consistent, and accurate decision-making throughout the adult protection investigation process. Use of this tool reduces the potential for bias and promotes equity through the use of evidence-based assessment tools. It provides evidence that can be used by law enforcement through the use of a standardized and organized assessment and documentation process, and it also promotes the rights of vulnerable adults through the use of the structured decision-making process that respects privacy and self-determination while promoting safety and protection. Counties support the use of this tool. The tool won the 2012 County Achievement Award from the Association of Minnesota Counties. This proposal does not change anything in statute regarding the function of the common entry point or the lead investigative agency regarding reports of maltreatment of vulnerable adults. It also does nothing to change the data practices requirements that govern adult protection data. Rather, this is a new tool that is available to counties to support their work. This proposal requires the use of the tool by all counties. And with that, I can take questions on that section.
Members, we have this before us because this section of law is typically reviewed by the Judiciary Committee. Where does the information from this tool, or who has access to this information that's in this tool, Ms. Shands?
Mr. Chair, the tool is was developed and is held by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. And we as a state have a contract with them as an organization. So the counties have access to the tool through a secure portal where they enter their own data. That organization has access to the data as well as DHS.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I have a question regarding on line 21 of page 5. These are the
Senator Limmer, we were going to ask Ms. Shands to explain change on page 5 in a moment. So maybe she'll answer your question when she gives that explanation.
Perhaps.
But I at least wanted to see if there are any further questions or concerns about the proposed changes in section 15. Okay, Senator Limmer, why don't you ask your question, and then Ms. Shands can address that as part of her presentation on that provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shands, there's a reference to Social Security numbers on line 21, but also on line 22, there's a medical assistance identification number. Now, oftentimes one is interchangeable, I thought, on medical data. And do you know if that's true, or are we going in a new direction, or is this something that's been around for a long time? I guess the question is, why are we using Social Security numbers when we already have a medical ID number to identify a person?
Ms. Shands.
Mr. Chair, members, the section that you are asking about has to do with some changes in the bill having to do with nursing home resident relocation. And unfortunately, I'm not the individual to be able to answer questions on that area, but I've got my colleague here, Stacy Meyer, who can hopefully address your question.
Welcome, Ms. Myers.
Hi, thank you. It's Stacy Meyer with Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it's my understanding that not all enrollees might not have one of these numbers, hence why both numbers are put on to make sure someone that they're able to be identified somewhere in the system.
I know, Mr. Chair, that Social Security numbers we discuss a lot in data privacy conversations, but the Social Security number is so sensitive to gaining access to a whole host of detailed, intimate knowledge of people because everyone relies on a Social Security number. And even though we make federal law and state law specifically in some cases expresses a desire not to use Social Security for identification purposes, it keeps cropping up all the time. And that's why I wanted to know. And if one removes Social Security number reference out of this bill, can your bill still work?
Ms. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I am not entirely sure of that. It's my understanding that both are needed to identify in case one is not there, but I cannot say that for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Pontius, do you have something to assist us with this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lambert, my understanding of this provision is it's actually intended to limit access to that information that's already collected right now. Right now you are using Social Security numbers and the medical assistant numbers. So this just says only the county social service agency is going to get that data.
Right.
So it actually restricts access.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Ms. Shands, would you like to explain the all of the subdivision 2 amendments there on page 5? Or Ms. Meyer, if that's your area, that's the other portion within this committee's consideration today.
Sure. Mr. Chair, again, Stacey Meyer with DHS. The changes in subdivision 2 are in regards to our nursing facility resident relocation law. And here we're is describing what happens when a notice is given that a facility is closing or downsizing, that the notice be provided to the individuals listed here in this subdivision. And we're just adding managed care organizations that would, if for enrollees who are enrolled in a managed care organization, to also receive that notice that the facility is closing.
Mr. Chair, one
Senator Limmer.
Just a little bit more information. On the data that's described on lines 20 through 22, is there a reference to the classification of how we classify that information? Is it considered private?
Classification for the
Mr. Chairman, I think this is all
Ms.
private
Pontius.
Data.
All private. And it's limited to the social service agency that it would have. I see on line 20 only the copy of the notice provided to the county social service agency shall include, and then they have the data there. It's classified as private. I'm assuming that the access is limited to the social service agency.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. So that portion of the data would just go to that agency. The other entities would find out about a closure, but they wouldn't get the more detailed census data.
And Mr. Chair and Council, are there consequences to the department or to an individual if they breach the security on the privacy classification on this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, you always have the Data Practices Act remedies.
That's what it would refer
right,
that to.
Those apply whenever. So.
Right. Okay.
Okay, are there any other questions or discussion relating to the proposed changes here? Hearing none. Senator Limmer, would you like to move?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File Number 459 be recommended to pass and proceed where?
To the Senate floor.
The floor.
Yes. Last stop.
All right.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Eakin. All right. We're now going to pick up where we left off this afternoon. And that was Senator Sharon. Put it on tonight. So we now have before us Senate File 490, Senator Sharon, relating to Minnesota Commitment and Treatment Act.
And, thank you very much.
Senator Sharon, is this your first stop?
It is.
I understand you have an author's amendment.
I have an oral amendment, I think.
But you have an oral amendment?
You should have a copy of it.
We've got noted that we have a delete-all amendment.
Oh, yes. We have a delete-all amendment.
So this is a correction to the delete-everything amendment.
Yes.
Okay. So let's make sure
that we have a delete all amendment, a correction to the delete all amendment.
So let's, members, make sure you have the delete everything amendment in front of you first.
Here it is.
Is that part of the back?
That's just coming out. Oh, the delete everything was
delete everything
there
amendment.
Earlier, but.
Delete everything on
the table. Patrick, I need a copy.
gave us this as well. It actually annotated, shows where all of the people moved.
Okay, is that in the packet?
It was passed out earlier. This is an extra one. I got two, so you can have
it. Thank you.
That could be.
Okay, so members, what you should have in front of you is the RA13-022 delete everything amendment. And you should have two versions of it. One is in the standard form on the 8.5 by 14 page piece of papers. And then also we have an annotated version on regular letter size paper where in the right column there are annotations indicating specifically what's being done with each change. But this is an author's amendment, so I think what we should do first is adopt the proposed amendment to the author's amendment, which has been handed out. And the amendment on the sort of separate one-page piece of paper, it says to amend line 14.8 by striking. So that'll be the amendment to the author's amendment.
Okay.
Senator Goodwin, will you
yes.
Move that? Senator Goodwin moves the. I'm sorry, Senator Sheeran, you're on the committee. You can move your own
yes.
author's
yes,
amendment.
Yes, I'm happy to move the author's amendment to the delete all amendment.
Okay, so Senator Sheeran, first we'll move to amend the amendment. Move the amendment to the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Now we have before us the RA13-022 amendment as amended. Senator Sheeran moves adoption of that amendment as the author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. So now the bill in front of us, members, is the author's amendment as amended, the RA13-22. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you very much. As a way of introducing the bill, I would just like to talk a bit about this process that we're engaged in. When we as Minnesotans decided to craft legislation for sexual psychopathic personalities and for sexually dangerous persons, the statutory language that we created at that time when that civil commitment process was developed was placed on top of and intermingled with the language for individuals who are committed as mentally ill or mentally ill and dangerous. At that time, this was viewed as an efficient way to codify this because of the similarities between the commitment procedures for these two groups, people. However, it's become clear as the legislature works to move ahead with reforms to the civil commitment language for sex offenders, that the statutory structure is problematic. For example, there are now appropriate differences between the role of the special review board with individuals who are committed as sexually dangerous persons or as psychopathic personalities. In 2011, the Office of the Legislative Auditor recommended a statutory split. In addition, in 2011, the legislature passed law directing the Commissioner of Human Services to work with the Office of the Revisor to review the statute and create a new chapter within the commitment statute, MS-253B. This bill is responsive to that directive. So this creates that new statute, new chapter within the statute 253B that you'll see referred to as 253D. As you know, there are many types of reform being discussed now on how Minnesota uses its civil commitment process for sex offenders. Now, this bill is not designed at this time to make these reforms that are being discussed, but rather creates clean workspace within the statutes regarding civil commitment for any reforms that the legislature or the courts might choose to pursue. Currently, Minnesota is the only state which has civil commitment language for civil commitment for sex offenders intertwined with other types of commitment language. They too report that this is a problematic way for the criteria and for procedures for civil commitment for this population because of the potential unintended consequences for other populations, other non-sex offender populations. There's no substantive changes in this language. This was done purposefully so that other policy decisions could impact this population, the sex offender population, without concerns for unintended consequences for individuals committed as mentally ill and dangerous. So over the last 2 years, this language has been vetted through other stakeholders, including the county attorneys, public defenders, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and organizers that work on behalf of victims. These stakeholders agree that this language fulfills its intent to create a separate workplace in statute for the future policy changes and in order to have those be most effective by separating these and creating a new chapter that relates specifically to commitment to sexually dangerous persons or sexual psychopathic personalities. So that gives you some context for what it is that's presented in front of you. And I think I will turn it over to our testifiers to help walk through the specific language of the bill. And I don't know, so I would invite Robin View Benson, who's Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Human Services, with your permission, Senator Latz, to review the contents of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Mr. View Benson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Rather than going line by line or section by section, I think it may be more expedient to highlight the bigger picture items. As Senator Sharon remarked, this is more of a recodification. There are no substantive changes. The directive from the legislature in 2011 was to provide statutory separation and make the laws regarding sex offender civil commitment distinguished from those that are providing for other forms of civil commitment, and that is what this bill does. Members have two resource documents that we've provided. One is a single page or two pages stapled together titled Recodification of Sex Offender Civil Commitment Provisions from Chapter 253B to Chapter 253D. That provides an overview of the changes and describes them in enough detail to give members a sense of what's being affected here. In general, the structure of the bill is that the first, I think, nine sections fix existing language in 253B in preparation for its renumbering, which is achieved later on in the bill, into 253D. Such things as consistent terminology, cross-references, and items that need to have a home both in 253B and in 253D. Then the second part of the bill, sections 9 through 19, looks like it contains a lot of new language. However, most of that language is not new to the statute. It is language that exists in 253B now under current law, and because it needs to stay in 253B for those proceedings, but also be available in 253D for the sex offender civil commitment proceedings, it is being replicated in large part in those sections. Sections 20 and 21 are important in that they speak to the legislature's intent about not affecting existing court rules or not intending to change the substance of law, particularly with respect to the other populations that we're trying to achieve the separation with. And then Section 22 does the heavy lifting by providing the renumbering of the existing sections into the 253 D area. The other resource that's been provided is, as Mr. Chair, you mentioned, is the letter-sized copies of the Delete All Amendment that contain annotations in the right margin. Those annotations identify what's being done in the bill and gives members an opportunity if if they have a question about something, to look at that, and perhaps that'll answer it. Otherwise, we're certainly available to explain things. I think that perhaps now would be, now I'm ready for questions.
Mr. V. Benson, I do have a question. Sections 9 and 19, you said there was some replication. It looks like from the description that there are some provisions that would be common to both types of commitments that are not replicated. They're simply cross-referenced?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So if one were to try to determine what's the appropriate procedure for dealing with the 253D situations, you would, in fact, have to go back and read the cross-references back in 253B. Is that right?
Yes, for a subset of main procedural items in that. And those cross-references are used so that there was not a need for a lot of duplication of existing language. For example, with 253B092, which provides procedures for administering neuroleptic medications, an important reason to have a cross-reference to that rather than to copy that is to ensure that the same procedures are going to be followed for that particular circumstance for both populations. In other instances, a decision was made that the cross-reference would be sufficient, but because there is that section or subdivision that's now created in 253D, it allows, as Senator Sharon was saying, that if the legislature were to have activity in those areas, there would be a place for the activity to go.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee relating to any of these proposed changes?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Sharon, I see on lines 5.22, there's a reference to clear and convincing evidence standard. And is this continuing the standard from current law?
Ms. Sharon, Senator Sharon.
Or anyone at the table.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it is continuing the existing standard. The standard is provided for in 253B18, which under current law you have to first go to 253B185 subdivision 1 paragraph A that tells you that things that apply to mentally ill and dangerous apply to the sex offender categories. This provision takes away all the intermediary steps and takes that and puts it right where it needs to be.
Mr. Chair, one of the in a lot of the discussions that we've been having about this area of law, one common theme keeps coming up, and that's the application of uniformity as it applies to individuals who may be judged appropriate for a civil commitment. And there seems to be a lack of uniformity across the state due to a variety of jurisdictional venues. And is this bill going to try and address any of that, or is this just kind of a housekeeping rewrite of existing law?
Mr. V. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, this is purely housekeeping. It sets up the space if someone wanted to do something substantive later on.
Okay.
I would add to that, though,
Senator,
that
sure.
Those issues in that conversation is part of what we will need to be doing, and this simply creates the separation, actually another subchapter, and separates these populations so that we can implement changes that are appropriate for this population but may not be appropriate for the mentally ill and dangerous. So this sole purpose of this is to
separate,
and okay. That's really all it accomplishes.
Okay.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers, could you look at 6.18, 6.19? I just have a question. It strikes out as a sexual psychopathic personality, and then it puts in the next line, a person with a sexual psychopathic personality. What's the change for?
Mr. Hugh Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hall, that change is something that is made throughout the bill, and the need for it is an illustration of kind of where we've come. As we were reviewing the existing law, there are a variety of combinations and ways of stating those two commitment categories. So one of the things that we were attempting is to provide consistency even in something as innocuous as what the order in which these two commitment categories are listed and how they are phrased so that we have that kind of common language and there's no confusion about what is applying to who.
Yeah.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did notice the order was changing. That was, of course, another question I had, but you decided not to go with a person with a sexually dangerous personality and just kept it as person then. And that was specific, though.
Yes.
I'm sure you've got good reason. I just wondered if you actually knew the reason.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall,
Mr. Hugh Benson.
The 20-some years that this, or almost 20 years that this sexually dangerous person's sexual psychopathic personalities provisions has been in the book, it's been amended several times, and in doing so, it creeps in some of the inconsistencies. In terms of the sexually dangerous persons versus sexual psychopathic personalities, the history of where that originated from, I think, is that before 1994, there was a category called psychopathic personalities. So an individual with a psychopathic personality is the derivation of the current sexual psychopathic personalities. And then the addition of a sexually dangerous person, I guess the short answer is I don't know.
Okay. I appreciate that. So this is a convoluted legislative history, but this bill will make everything consistent.
That works, too.
To a fair conclusion?
Yes, and
Senator Sheeran.
And primarily separates in a separate subdivision in the civil commitment chapter, this civil commitment language for the mentally ill and dangerous from the psychopathic personality or the sexually dangerous person. That's the real goal that we're trying to accomplish here without substantive change, excepting for those things that relate specifically to the sex offender.
All right. Are there any further questions or discussion from the committee? Senator Sheeran, you have another person with you, Ms. Brandt. Do you have anything to add to the discussion, or have we covered it?
No, Mr. Chair and committee members, I do not. I'm the legislative director for MSOP, and I believe my colleague, Robin Vivenson, has summarized things quite well.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to be heard on this matter? Mr. Kerwin is suspiciously silent there. Are you here on this bill, John?
I am, Mr. Chair. Everything looks fine to us.
Okay. So the agency supports it, as we know. All right. Any further discussion? Not hearing any further discussion, Senator Sheeran moves that Senate File 490, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sheeran.
Thank you very much.
Senator Goodwin, Senate File 668. Senator Goodwin, we have before us Senate File 668.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This legislation simply clarifies that a supervised release period and a conditional release period are to run concurrently. We believe that this was a legislative intent when conditional release was originally passed by the legislature. The reason this issue is coming up because there was an appeals court ruling that said that the period of supervised release and the period of conditional release are consecutive, not concurrent. And I will let Dylan Workington, the Director of Community Corrections for Anoka County, tell you why that is a possible danger to the public.
Mr. Workington, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I appreciate, first of all, the opportunity to be here, and also thank Senator Goodwin for working with us on this problem that we foresee. As you know, offenders committed to the Commissioner of Corrections in Minnesota serve two-thirds of their time incarcerated. Upon release, predatory offenders have a conditional release period and a supervised release period. The supervised release period is one-third, as with normal felons coming out of the institution, and predatory offenders have the additional 10-year period of conditional release. What's happened is that the purpose of this legislation is to clarify that the period of supervised release and the period of conditional release are to run seamlessly or concurrently. Since the inception of conditional release, the two periods of time were considered concurrent to one another. If an offender violated a condition of the supervised release period and was sent back to the institution, the offender could remain in custody even if the supervised release period ended. The offender would remain in prison in a seamless manner as long as the period of conditional release was part of the original sentence. Two court decisions interpreted the statute to mean that the period of supervised release and the period of conditional release were consecutive, not concurrent, and therefore not seamless. What that means is that if an offender is released from prison on supervised release and subsequently violates his or her conditions of release, he or she can only be returned to the prison for whatever time is left on the initial supervised release portion and not stay in custody in a seamless fashion. So for many of these offenders, they may be ordered to go back by the Department of Corrections for, let's say, additional treatment. They're in the middle of the treatment, the supervised release period comes to an end, and they need to be released, and they can't complete it despite the fact that there's jurisdiction remaining. The problem arises when a predatory offender has minimal period of supervised release and violates in a substantial manner, such as absconding supervision, having contact with minors, or refusing mental health treatment. The current interpretation states that the offender must be re-released as soon as the supervised release period ends. This creates a loophole. Offenders can plan a major violation of supervision during their supervised release period, knowing that they can only be held until that period ends, and then they must be re-released. This means that they can control their own consequences. This also means that unstable offenders may be re-released from prison to the community without sufficient planning or accountability, and this may place the community at greater risk. You may ask the question why Anoka County Corrections is concerned about this, and it's because once the appellate court decided this and the Department of Corrections changed its release policy commiserate to that decision, we had an offender who was released right after we violated his supervision for substantial reasons and was re-released in a very unstable manner. This legislation simply clarifies that. In essence, it's kind of a house cleaning, and we do believe that it was the intent of the original legislation to run concurrently to avoid this issue. We believe that the legislative intent of the conditional release was originally set in that manner for good reason, so that we did not have a break in period. The original statute that is addressed here talks about the supervised release period being minused from the conditional release. And so there's a language piece that the appellate court got a little twisted on, I believe, but they read it right. They decided the case on the way it was written, but not the way it was practiced or intended. So for many years since conditional release came into fruition, it was operated by the Department of Corrections as well as Community Corrections Act counties for those folks who supervise these cases as concurrent, and allowing, therefore, the ability to consequence offenders in a seamless manner. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair and Senators, we wholeheartedly from Anoka County support the legislative shift, and also as part of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act counties, we also support this shift as well.
So Thank you, Mr. Workington. I do have a question then. So the bill before us, it makes these changes for each of the separate statutory provisions, the sentencing provisions relating to the convictions for the different offenses that are involved. So are all the predatory offenders covered here? Is that it?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The statute, actually, if you follow it through with all the statutes, makes the identical changes. And I also note that the House file, when there's a House bill as well that goes along with this, makes the exact changes. So it seems fairly consistent all the way through.
Are there any questions or discussion from the committee? Senator Dietzen.
Thank you. I just want to clarify. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the other Community Correction Acts counties agree with this too?
Or are we just
as Anoka, as a Community Corrections Act?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzen, yes. We vetted this through the Association of Community Corrections Act counties. And I'm here not only on behalf of Anoka County, but on those counties as well.
Anyone in the audience wish to be heard on this? Any further discussion? Senator Goodwin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to pass Senate File 668 to the floor. I don't think it has to go anywhere else.
That's our information as well. There being no further discussion, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 668 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you,
Senator Goodwin. Senator Jensen.
Excuse me, Senator Latz. Do we have an agenda for this evening that I just can't find?
Everyone else was given an agenda. Senator.
I bet you withheld one from me on purpose.
we'll take a look and we will find one to provide you.
Thank you.
Any other member of the committee does not have an agenda? All right, Senator Jensen, we have before Senate File 803, Statewide Radio Board Provisions Modifications. Senator Jensen, is this your first appearance before the Judiciary Committee?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
All right, members. Wait, where's Senator Limmer?
Oh, no. I got to get in on these initiations.
Limmer stepped aside here. Can we track Senator Limmer down, please? We have a first-time appearance here, Senator Limmer, so don't shirk your duties now.
Oh, no.
Thank you.
I forgot to warn you about this.
Senator Jensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, I think.
We have before us Senate File 803. Why don't you go ahead and explain. Senator Limmer has a question already. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for upholding the fine tradition of the Judiciary Committee. We always love to welcome our new senators to the committee on their very first bill. Senator Hoffman, that probably means you too. So we'll see how it goes.
Senator Jensen, would you please describe your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I have before you today is some changes that are related to Statute 403, the Emergency and Public Safety Communications section. Statute 403 governs the technical and operational oversight of two public safety emergency communication networks, the 911 network and the statewide radio network that is referred to now as ARMR. You might know it as 800 megahertz system. There needs to be an expansion and an update for the authority of the Statewide Radio Board so that they can incorporate the latest technology that would then fall under the board's oversight structure. Currently, the board is considered a model governance structure that allows regional elected officials and radio users to influence the technical and the operational standards of the statewide radio system. This statute change would allow that governance structure to influence all emergency public safety communications. The policy updates would also allow the expansion of the statewide radio board to include the latest emergency communication technology and the 911 and wireless broadband for public safety, as well as allowing federally recognized tribal governments at their request to be integrated into the regional board structure as well. It's important to note that this does not impact the 911 fee as it currently exists. We're expanding the authority of the statewide radio board to act as an emergency communications board, and that would ensure that all voice and data public safety communications would be able to be done statewide. And we feel that it meets the current needs of the public, and it meets the minimum operational and technical standards that ensure immediate and accurate emergency responses to 911 requests by public safety professionals. This bill has been looked at and held in favor by the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Police Chiefs, Minnesota Fire Chiefs, Minnesota Ambulance Association, the Metropolitan Emergency Service Board, and public safety professional organizations. With that, I have with me Jackie Mines from the Emergency Communications Network.
Ms. Mines, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the Department of Public Safety has a division called Emergency Communication Networks, and it is our mission to fund and support through the 911 fee the interoperable public safety grade communication solutions that permit public safety officials, emergency personnel, state and federal agencies to communicate easily with each other and provide immediate assistance to Minnesota citizens and any visitors that request emergency assistance. The division manages two programs, the 911 program or the 911 network, and the statewide radio system known as ARMOR. Today, as we're moving forward, both of these systems had been older systems. We are in the process of completing the ARMOR upgrade around the state, and we currently have approximately 71 counties on the system and more are still interested out of the 87. We are also embarking on a upgrade of the 911 network, and we are looking at updating our 403 statute to accommodate those changes in technology. And the first thing that we are hoping to do is to broaden the existing statewide radio board structure to an emergency communication board. These different communications systems have sort of operated separately, but there's one funding source, and quite frankly, we need to make sure that as we're rolling out this new technology that the same types of operational standards are met throughout the state. And we think that this existing board structure would give us that opportunity to work with all the stakeholders, such as we did with the ARMOR build-out and rollout, and be able to influence local dispatch centers to have a uniform methodology of answering telephone calls for 911. And with that, I'll open it up for any questions of me.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Mines, or in particular for Senator Jensen? Senator Hall?
I don't thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think Senator Jensen maybe can necessarily handle this one, but are we mandating anything to any of the cities or emergency groups? Is there any mandate in here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall,
Senator Jensen.
This would be completely voluntary for the local governments. It's important to work on the trust that's been built over the process of what we already have out there. So the people would be voluntary.
And follow up,
Senator Hall.
Is there a cost to this? I know we don't necessarily get into that, but.
Senator Hall,
Senator
my understanding is that the funding source is the 911 fee that's already out there utilized, and that's what
Great.
This would be based on as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Jensen, do you know if we've talked about the ARMOR program for a great many years in the legislature? Have we finally accomplished a total saturation of armor frequency throughout the state?
Senator Johnson.
Senator Limmer, the armor there has been 70. I might have to refer to.
It's like 83%. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 71 counties have migrated to the armor system. There are 16 counties approximately that are not on the system as of yet, and about 7 or 8 of them have just passed board resolutions to look at coming onto the armor system. There are a few counties that upgraded their radio systems to VHF, and the state did build a VHF overlay system so that we can still communicate with them. So from that perspective, we have met the FCC mandate that was just due this past December, and we have been communicating in various capacities. An example is most of the counties that have not migrated are in the Northwest, and there was a significant fire up in the Roseau County area last fall, and they used the 800 cash radios from the state and neighboring regions and used that with their VHF radios and communicated across systems and across various emergency personnel. So we're finding that it's been very successful, and I think with those different experiences, that's created some additional interest in the Northwest.
One other question, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mimes, in Section 8, you make reference to a future implementation of next generation 911. Do we need an armor frequency foundation to make that work, or is it independent of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way Next Generation 911 really affects the network is the calls coming into the dispatch center, whereas the radio system is really communication with the responding agency sort of on the other end of that call. So they are interrelated, and they will become more so with the newer technology that we're looking at, but they still sort of operate independently from that perspective. One doesn't supersede the other.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Mimes, on Section 7, we talk about recognizing Indian tribal governments with, is that the armor program? And do they involve themselves in that at their expense, just like any other political subdivision?
Ms. Mimes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. They in some cases are independent within the county and answering their own calls and responding to their own calls. And in those cases, those tribal organizations have come to those regional radio boards and asked if they could participate with them so they could purchase the technology and ride on the backbone of the armor network.
And one other last question, Mr. Chair. This is just a curiosity. Is there any dead spots in the state of Minnesota where law enforcement can't get a radio signal of some sort?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, with any technology, there's going to probably be a few areas that we're going to have trouble with. The northeast section in the Boundary Waters Canoe area has some potential to have some dead spots. And we are continuing to work on those as we get the system built out. So currently today, there are scheduled to be 324 towers around the state on this backbone. And we have 296 of those built. And there are still some that we're working on land acquisition. We also know that once you get a number of different organizations on the system and they start using it, we will be able to see more of those areas of that may need a little boost or may need additional microwave or subsystems. And We're still discovering those things. We've been focused on building these towers and getting everybody on the system, and now the next portion of this year we will be looking at where are those spots and what can we do to mitigate them.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I brought that up is I have a nephew who happens to be a state trooper in the state of Wyoming. And Wyoming's a very desolate state, or parts of it. And there are a few spots that he's very careful of how he pulls people over in a dead zone where there's no radio. The command structure that they have wouldn't even know that he's pulling someone over, let alone doing a back search for a warrant or a license plate check. And he's kind of approaching a car completely cold. And he told me of a particular harrowing incident where it was he alone with four other men in another car, and they all decided to get out of the car at once. And it got to be fairly involved. But as soon as I heard that, my concern was, do we have any dead spots in Minnesota? And that should be a priority of ours, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Anyone else in the room wish to add to the discussion? Senator Limmer, you seem particularly...
Well, I'm not sure about this Jensen thing.
Well, you know, let me just see if there's anyone on the committee that's willing to make a motion.
I am, Mr. Chair. I'll make the motion.
Barely even a pause.
How long have you been on the committee, Senator?
2 years, Mr. Chair.
Well,
just
a
new chair.
New.
Just
you are new.
She finally speaks up.
Mr. Chair, I do believe Senator that it Jensen. Needs to be referred to state and local government.
Oh. Yeah, that's what we have. All right, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 803 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on State and Local Government. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion. No.
With one loud dissent, the bill passes and is referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Senator Sharon, Senate File 347.
Senator Latz, is Senate File 347 going to the floor?
234.
If we pass it, yes.
Yes, okay. very good. Then do you want me to make a motion now and then explain the bill, or how would you like to proceed?
Go ahead and explain the bill and then entertain your motion.
Well, thank you very much. This is Senate File 347. It's the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act update. I have with me Judge Harriet Lansing from the Uniform Law Commissioner to help explain the bill and what the bill is about. As a way of background, Senate File 347 improves international recognition and enforcement of Minnesota child support orders. And although the United States fairly routinely enforces child support orders issued by foreign jurisdictions, reciprocity is often lacking when cases are originating in the United States, reviewed abroad, so it's not reciprocal. But in November of 2007, the United States signed the Hague Convention on International Recovery of Child Support and Other Forms of Family Maintenance. So this is international. The Hague Convention provides recognition and enforcement for many, many children in the United States that have child support cases that currently involve a party in the United States who either seeks or owes support. Senate File 347 amends the Uniform Act by establishing procedures for processing international child support cases. These amendments serve as the implementing legislation for the convention, the Hague Convention, and the condition of our passage of this at the state level is important to us because you know, there's always a little stick behind these things, and if we want to continue to collect federal child support funds, it requires us to enact Senate File 347 within a certain required time period. So the amendment of Minnesota's Uniform Interstate Family Support Act will improve enforcement of Minnesota child support orders abroad, and it will also help ensure that children residing in Minnesota will receive their financial support from parents no matter where the parents reside. And that's really, in essence, what the bill is about. I just want to restate for the members of the committee that Minnesota's continued collection of the federal child support funds requires us enacting 347 within a certain time period, and that is when Congress enacts the implementing legislation. The Congress is anticipated to do that in fairly short order. Congress has already implemented a file related to this, is expected to reenact it. There is no disagreement in the Senate in relationship to it, so it's not controversial and it's likely to pass. And the state of Minnesota will have a short time period in order to act at the state level to get into compliance with this, and that's why we are coming to you at this time to ready ourselves and to have in law what we need in order to be in compliance with federal law. And the other important thing to remember is that with this Senate File 347, Minnesota's authority regarding child support issues is preserved. And without the enactment, the federal government may claim that it is unable to achieve good faith state implementation of the Hague Convention. The federal government may then attempt to federalize the entire process under its treaty power. The costly and confusing ramifications would result in a less reliable law on this important area of for children. So with that, I'm hoping that you will ask questions, tough questions of our guest. And I'd like you to know that the Minnesota State Bar Association and the American Bar Association endorsed this act, and the necessary changes have been worked through with stakeholders. And on the bill, there's a delayed effective date that aligns with federal legislation. And so with that, I would certainly ask, would you like to make some specific comments in relationship to the bill? Judge Harriet Lansing.
Judge, thank you. You're used to being the one asking the questions of the persons, so circumstance reversed. We'll try not to take too much advantage of it. But, welcome to the committee, Judge. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Chairman Lance. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am here to answer questions. Senator Sharon has given you a very comprehensive overview of what it is that the reasons that we think that we need to update the laws that relates to the Interstate Family Support Acts. I should say that I'm joined here tonight by Julie Erickson from the Department of Human Services and Lisa Kantz, the Assistant Dakota County Attorney who works in their Child Support Enforcement Division to also assist if there are questions that relate to sort of hands-on application of the current reciprocal program. In addition to the things that Senator Sharon has already pointed out, I would just say that not to overemphasize the carrot and stick concept, but I did determine the amount of money that was at stake in terms of the 4D funding distributed to Minnesota. And in the since 2006, every year that amount has exceeded $100 million. And our most recent statistic in 2012 was $104,778,532. So,
but Judge Lansing, this is money which is coming from others out of overseas?
No, I'm sorry. This is the federal distribution of child support under Section 4D to the state of Minnesota, that if we are not in compliance with the provisions of essentially what has been provided here in this act as incorporating the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Forms of Family Maintenance, we're required to be in compliance or those funds would be withheld. And that originated in 1996. There was a provision that this happily Minnesota was in compliance because in 1994 you had adopted the original Uniform Law Commission Act on the for the child support orders, and so we have been in compliance. It's just that when this new legislation is passed by Congress, which we anticipate will be this year, because it, as Senator Sharon adverted to, it was passed by the House in June of 2012, and it's not ever been a controversial issue with the Senate because they initially gave advice and consent to the convention by a two-thirds vote. So it is likely that that will go through quite readily, and we'll then be in the situation where we will have to be in compliance or we could risk our 4D child support funds.
Thank you.
I don't believe that I have anything further. I think that 10 other states have already worked it into their family support statutes: Florida, Maine, Missouri, Nevada, New Mexico, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Utah, and Wisconsin. And several states, including Washington, Georgia, and Puerto Rico, have introduced the act in their 2013 legislatures.
Are there any questions for Judge Lansing or Senator Sharon? Senator Lemus?
Chair. Judge, I'm glad you included the number of states that have passed this law. We commonly get uniform law proposals, and when I ask the question how many states are adopting a uniform law, it's very low in the single digits, and it kind of defeats the sales pitch a little bit that it may not be as uniform as we think. But I'm glad you brought that up with 10 and with maybe four other states considering it. My concern is there's references for foreign countries on this, and would this make enforcement easier or maybe not make it any easier at all? Is it difficult for another state or a foreign nation to enforce our laws? Or is the purpose of this to make all laws the same for the enforcement mechanism to work? Could you maybe expand on the enforcement aspect?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer.
Judge Lansing.
Essentially, there's the concept of reciprocity. So the idea is that these procedures should work as efficiently and as free of transaction costs as we can possibly do that in taking care of the interests of these children to obtain the support that they should get. Currently, I would say that we have, within the United States, been more inclined to assure that those procedures are in place than we find in other countries. So I would say that although it is intended to be evenly balanced in that respect, the benefit is probably with the United States in terms of what we're trying to achieve here, because we're trying to get other countries to respond as promptly as we do and to enforce the orders, to establish the orders, and to respect the orders of the United States. I spoke briefly with Lisa and also with Julie this evening about the problems that we currently encounter where we just have the reciprocal interaction without bringing in these concepts of the convention. And it, we're really doing it on a case-by-case basis. In fact, I think you had a very good example of it in your 2011-2012 session when you considered an act to direct the Commissioner of Human Services to enter into a reciprocal agreement with Bermuda to establish and enforce child support obligations. And I believe that that was authored by Senator Ortman. So it's like having to establish, to proceed on a country-by-country basis over and over again. You have to start from the ground up when you get one of these in. So if we could systematize the process, the United States would be in a far, far better position to be able to collect the necessary child support to protect these children. And I think, and it was the United States who initiated this in the Hague conference initially, and we were one of the first signatories.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Judge Lansing or Senator Sharon? Anyone in the audience wish to be heard on this bill? Senator Sharon?
I renew my motion to pass Senate File 347 and refer it to the floor.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 347 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Judge. I'll take up Senator Hoffman's bill, Senate File 638. Senator Hoffman, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, and members of the infamous Judiciary Committee, this is my first time in front of you.
That reputation must have been from years past.
Absolutely. And,
prior
Mr.
to January of 2013.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 638.
And happy, it is a National Cheese Doodle Day today. I see the snacks back there, so, you know, it's an honor to be in front of you. No, seriously, in all sincerity, I'm honored to be in front of you, and I would ask, Mr. Chair and members, before we look at the bill, I can't offer it, but in front of you is going to be an author's amendment to 638, and it's going to be SCS 0638A1, the A1 amendment. Is that?
It's members, it's being distributed right now.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's just a couple of grammatical edits. And if we could get some authority to move beyond that, then I can talk to you about the Senate File 638.
This is an author's bill, Senator Sharon.
I'm wondering if before any motion is introduced, if we can reconsider the motion on my bill to refer to the floor. Apparently there is a fiscal note, and so it will have to be referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
All right. Well, there's a Senator Sharon moves to reconsider.
Do you want me to withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair?
I didn't recognize it. Senator.
Did you have a motion on this other bill?
Yeah.
Sharon moves to reconsider the vote whereby Senate File 347 was recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All in favor of the reconsideration say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Sharon now moves that Senate File 347 be recommended to pass and be referred to Senate Finance Committee.
Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Senator Hoffman, Senate File 638. All the members now have the author's amendment in front of them, the A1 amendment. Senator Goodwin moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr.
In the shape you want it in.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 638 really makes some small changes to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, specifically Minnesota Statutes Chapter 13. And you're going to hear, I'm going to do a brief overview of it, and then we'll hear from Laura Beyer Kropinski, who's the Director of Community Services Division in Admin, and she'll go a little deeper into what we're trying to do here. But essentially, in clarifying certain data maintained by the Department of Administration, it is private. But specifically, this bill classifies as private the data that's identified in individuals with disabilities that are taking part of the STAR program. And the STAR program over in the Centennial Building is the system of technology to achieve results. They provide direct service to individuals with disabilities as the federally funded AT, the Assistive Technology Center in Minnesota. And those folks with disabilities and their family members have access to device loans, device demonstrations, reuse training, and then information and assistance. Here's where there's some gaps that need to change. The data maintained by STAR is currently public based on the presumption of public data. However, individuals with disabilities who currently share the disability information with other entities such as the Department of Human Services and private providers have privacy in their data because of the laws that apply to those entities. As admin doesn't have a law that currently protects personal identifying information and data about individuals with disabilities, we believe this needs to change. And so individuals with disabilities and their families support protecting data that identifies them. And the other thing it does is if the information's out there publicly, you have potential some vulnerable adults that would be at risk there. So this cleans up that section of the law and really protects their personal identifiable information as data privacy. And with that, Mr. Chair and members of the board, I present to you Laura Beyer Kropinski with the Department of Administration.
Thank you, Ms. Beyer Kropinski. Maybe as part of your presentation, you can help me understand. I thought that data that is classified as private in any particular setting, when it migrates to a different location, it retains its status as private data. Does that not apply here, or is that not correct?
Mr. Chair and members, the chairman is right. When data comes from one government entity to another, it will travel with that same classification. This information is given directly from people with disabilities or their family members. So this is the nature of my disability or my husband's disability. This is where we live. This is the kind of devices that we need. So it's coming directly from the person. So it fits under Minnesota's presumption that everything is going to be public. And this is, as Senator Hoffman pointed out, these are folks who are just typically used to sharing this kind of information in school settings where it's protected or with their health care provider or with Department of Human Services. They just never expect that this kind of information is going to be presumptively public. This program has been running. It is 100% federally funded at the Department of Administration since 1989, and they've never had a data request before. But one of the beauties of having me as your manager is there's going to be a look at data practices, and even though they've never had a request, we want to make sure that they have the data protection that the program participants really will expect. So this is only about the direct services that STAR provides to individuals and doesn't classify more data about the program so that we can ensure that there is transparency for the other activities, but that we really just want to hone in on the information that would make people possibly vulnerable. And if not, if there are any other questions, I can answer them for members as well.
Ms. Beyer Kropinski, it looks like from the information provided to us by the department, Minnesotans with one or more disabilities, 45.8% of them are ages 75 or older. So this is most definitely a population that could be perceived as vulnerable. If you add the 65 and older, you're up to 68%.
67.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you tell me what device, what are we talking about in terms, what does it mean, assistive technology?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon. Assistive technology can be a variety of things. A really simple example of that is when you have a magnifier so that you can read something. Other things can be communication devices. People who have had strokes or who have autism or ALS can have very extensive communication devices they use. It can be something as simple as a wheelchair and a ramp. It can really encompass an iPad or an app on your phone to help take a picture of a document that then can be translated and read to you if you have a sight impairment. So it can really be a variety of things, both from something that costs $5 to something that's, you know, $30,000. So it really is a very full range. And this really is, Minnesota STAR program serves people of all ages, all disabilities. So it's not limited to in any way. And as the chair mentioned, as folks age, typically we have more disabilities that people are trying to accommodate and still do all the things they love to do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, could you tell me on line 13, they make reference to a family member of an individual. How extended of a family is that family member to be? Is it a child or a parent, or is it a cousin, uncle, that type of thing?
Ms. Beyer-Krupinski.
Mr. Chair, member, we are intending it to be kind of the lay view of whichever family member calls to access services for their person, saying, my sister, my brother, my husband has a disability. This is the kind of things they need. This is, you know, assume that someone perhaps has challenged communicating on their own. So really any family member who gives their name and describes disability of another person, we want to be able to protect where they live, their home phone number, and that kind of information that identify them.
Mr. Chair, could it be an uncle? Could it be a cousin?
Mr. Chair, remember, it's really anyone in your family who's calling to help you get these kind of services.
Is there ever a difference of opinion from different family members who might give different information?
Ms. Beyer-Krupinski.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't think the program has ever really experienced. There's typically, you know, key family members who are trying to, you know, kind of all take what part of the services they can help their family member get. So we haven't really seen conflict in that way.
Okay. And one other question, Mr. Chair. We've had this discussion before whenever we make reference to federal law. Is this federal reference related to what's on the books this year? Could it be amended sometime in the future and still there might be a different Title 29 and Sections 3001 to 3007 in the future? And how do we avoid that?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a law that, like many other federal laws, that gets reauthorized every 5 years or so, and this is actually waiting to get reauthorized now. One of the reasons we have detailed the specific services that are provided so that if the federal law were to substantially change, we've really only classified data that identify individuals receiving these very specific services.
And, Mr. Chair, do we need to put a year on this reference, or is that appropriate or not?
Senator Limmer, I'd be reluctant if they were to make an amendment, then we'd be automatically out of compliance.
Okay. Mr. Chair, maybe counsel could help me. Could we be putting something into our law that, well, is it subject to change in the future, but still with the same reference?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I think the problem you're thinking of is more where the state is, like, cross-referencing a federal law for purposes of, well, let's say the tax code is probably the big one, where there you do have to do the annual updates to the, you know, Internal Revenue Code as amended through such a date. Whereas for this, you're just sort of, it's really more of a generic reference to a federal program, so I don't think the date is as much of a problem in that context.
All right. The reason I bring it up, Mr. Chair, is that, as we all know, there's significant changes in the medicine and the application of federal law to home medical insurance and that type of thing. And with all of the changes that have been going on, I'm just wondering if those could be seismic in proportion, and I'm just wondering if with this language we are going to avoid any change in law that may come about as that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's
Senator Lemire, we always have the right, if we don't like a change in federal law or feel we need to make an adjustment, to go back and change our laws.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemire, you know, FERPA is a Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act under that's 94-142, and that was established, this, established the data privacy piece for kids and youth with disabilities. The extension of that same spirit is in the Assistive Technology Act of 1998, and Jim, actually, Congressman Ramstad was one of the biggest supporters of this act in 98, if I recall, and that public law gets reauthorized every 5 years. This is just now saying that the individual people that participate in the STAR program, their information, personal identifiable information, is not public. And so I think, to answer to your question, I think we're protected in that sense, and that should not be any issues. Rather, that gap gets closed. So that's a great question.
Mr. Chair, the other question I had is, doesn't HIPAA cover this in data privacy?
No, Mr.
Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in HIPAA, there's not medically related services here that's billable toward MA, is my understanding. These are services that are provided due to the Technology Act. So, in the sense, HIPAA would not have a broad discovery on that because it's not.
All right. Any further questions? Any members of the audience wish to speak on this matter? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 638 as amended be recommended to pass. And I don't know where it goes to, though.
It goes to the floor.
Thank
All right. You. Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 638 be recommended to pass and go to the Senate as amended and go to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr.
Hoffman,
Chair.
It's your lucky day.
Absolutely. I am just sitting here wondering what you guys are going to throw at me, and I really appreciate it. This was a lot of
fun.
We
had
snacks. Thank you.
Senator Lemire.
In a better mood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemire, I'll tell Senator Eakin how lucky he was that you missed his first appearance here.
Oh, by the way, Senator Ortman did provide half of the snacks as well as Senator Hall.
The record will so reflect the cookies. Who said something about cookies?
They're back there, yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's see. We next have Senate File 681, Senator Dietzick, who is currying favor by letting us know that there are cookies in the back. And Senator Dietzick, we have an author's amendment to delete everything. Which is being passed out.
There's an A3 amendment.
Senator Dietzick, this is your first stop.
Yep.
And tell you what, why don't you go ahead and introduce the bill, and then we have the amendment passed out, we'll adopt it.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Good evening. Senate File 681 is another data bill. It specifically deals with the community crime prevention programs. We kind of discussed this briefly when Senator Scalzi was here. But there's a special section in the data bill that details security information that specifically discusses the community crime prevention program. So what this does is add the participants' mailing address, email addresses, and other digital data, digital email addresses. It classifies them as security information. Most of the communities that you represent have National Night Out or Night to Unite or community crime prevention programs where they may supply their email addresses to be on Black Club members or to participate in the Night to Unite or National Night Out. I have the list of all your communities that participate if you'd like me to read that, or I'll just be short and you can trust me that you all have them. So this bill keeps that information private when you sign up for those programs. That's pretty much the summary of the bill. If there are any questions, I have with me some representatives from the city of Minneapolis. We have talked to the League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota Chief of Police Associations, and several individual police departments that all support this bill.
I have with me Luther Kruger from the City of Minneapolis Crime Prevention Program. He can just share a few words.
Mr. Kruger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Latz and members of the committee. Minneapolis has, a long tradition of community policing and crime prevention programs. Since the 1980s, we've had National Night Out and block clubs and various other programs. And our innovative crime prevention programs have been recognized by various national groups, including the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Police Executive Research Forum, and so forth. Our virtual block club, which involves using the Internet to communicate crime prevention statistics, tips, and other critical information to our volunteers, it's been replicated around the country, just a few to name, Denver, Cincinnati, and Baltimore County. Those are three that I spoke with directly to help them get theirs set up, kind of replicating our program. In our approach to crime prevention in Minneapolis and many of your cities, we ask a lot of our partners. It might be something as simple as attending a block meeting to do some problem solving about some critical crime issues. It might be contacting owners of problem properties where some criminal activity is taking place, or it might be even toward the extreme end of the spectrum, submitting impact statements on chronic or violent offenders. So we're asking a lot of our community partners already. So it's critical that we have a level of trust with those community partners, especially with regard to their personal information, which we're entrusted with. They accept a certain amount of risk, but they don't want to. They don't accept risk that's put onto them recklessly. And if we weren't to add this to the bill, theoretically they could have a lot of personal information jeopardized. With the Internet age, of course, as you know, identity theft is one critical piece that could take place if their email address is released. I get requests all the time from block leaders when they get an alert. They'll email me and say, who else saw this and did they see my email address? If so, I don't want to be on it. It's a very sensitive issue for them. We have had rental property owners. We have a very robust partnership with them where we communicate with via the Internet. And several of them have had their email addresses spoofed. They've had fraudulent ads placed with their name and email address on Craigslist and so forth. We're hoping that this will be made private by this definition here, along with their address and phone numbers, as we have it in times past. That'll help us maintain that trust that we have with community partners and continue to innovate in making sure our crime prevention programs work for the communities.
Mr. Kruger, can you help me understand, I think you were alluding to it, but how the individuals who participate in this program are uniquely at risk in some way compared to the average citizen who signs up for an email notification list, something going on in the city government?
Sure, Chairman Lass and the committee. They're uniquely at risk due to their involvement directly addressing crime issues on their blocks and in their communities. I mentioned the impact statements. We ask a lot of our partners, and including being able to submit in court at sentencing for various offenders, a statement about the impact that crime has had on them personally. They're already kind of sticking their neck out that way, but they sure don't want the offenders involved to have their email address and possibly harass them or find out where they live through using that Internet address to kind of backtrack and so forth online.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have we had breaches in the information you've collected thus far?
Chairman Latz, Senator Hall, not Mr. that I'm aware of. I certainly have not had any any experience with that.
Okay. As I'm looking at the bill itself, actually, before we go any further, let's adopt the A3 amendment, the author's amendment.
I move the A3 amendment.
Well, I think
Senator Dzik moves the A3 amendment, author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So we've got, you're mending Section 13.37, Subdivision 1, Paragraph A, which defines security information. So it looks like we've got a provision already in statute which specifically recognizes that the information identifying these individuals who are participating in the kind of programs that Mr. Kruger is describing are entitled to a special level of protection in terms of their data. Am I understanding that correctly?
I believe so, yes. It's classified and, as security information.
And then this bill simply expands the kind of data or explicitly identifies a couple of other pieces of that identifying data in statute. Am I understanding that right?
That is correct. Mr. Neumeister does not believe that it needs to be put in there. I'll just share that with everybody. He came to tell me that. But I believe the city's attorney and I believe possibly Ms. Pontius suggested that if we want to be explicit, we should put it in.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Desick, what is the other digital addresses? What would that include?
Potentially a Twitter address or a Facebook address. Oh. We're kind of looking for, I believe that's right. We don't want to have to come back next year and all of a sudden amend for a bunch of other stuff. So.
Okay.
And some of those, like a Twitter address, other people may share it, but the person may go on and have it under a different name. And I have friends for work purposes have Facebook under a different name. So if they were to share that here and then you connect it with their real name, then you have a breach. So
if I'm trying to read and understand this actual statute that currently exists, and
correct.
It's, I'll have to say the sentence is a little bit hard for me to understand clearly, but is it fair to say that the concerns here are that people would be subject, already enumerated in statute, the risks include theft, tampering, improper use, attempted escape, illegal disclosure, trespass, or physical injury? Those are the risks that you're attempting to protect them from by keeping their email addresses and so on private?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So an example in, if you're a block club leader in an area that has a lot of crime and you have a problem property on your house that you know is gang related, it might even be a nuisance house, there's a lot of gang activity. Their members of that gang or relatives of some people that live at that house, if they find out, they want to know, and if they find out that you've called the police on them, they get upset and they've been known to retaliate. And so getting people to step up and, as Mr. Kruger said, participate is sometimes challenging. And we want them to sign up and get crime alerts and then to, be able to email Mr. Kruger or his other workers of problems, and especially if it's a nuisance property, they want 911 calls and, additional information so that they can track it. But if people are afraid that information is going to become public, they don't want to do it.
Mr. Chair.
And would this then apply to anyone who signs up to get crime alerts in their community, or is there some subset of persons that are involved in the block program that would be covered by this?
Chairman Latz and the committee, we define our crime prevention volunteers fairly broadly because we do ask sooner or later if they sign up for our crime alerts, sooner or later we're going to ask them to be involved in some way, shape, or form. As I mentioned before, for instance, impact statements. The closer they are to the crime pattern that is involved with a particular offender, the more likely we're going to ask them to participate and sign up to fill out an impact statement on an offender. So we would like to consider that if they're a crime alert recipient, they've kind of stepped forward to say that they are a volunteer. In fact, the system is set up where they can check the box saying how they're involved as a block club member, block leader, McGruff House, National Night Out coordinator, et cetera. So it's very, once we get their information, we seek all sorts of ways to get them involved very directly in the programs that we have.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair. Might there be other types of information that in the future you may want to get from some of these volunteers? And if so, would you want to add something that was a little broader? For instance, do you get information now, or might you in the future get information about their family members that you wouldn't want to be able to let out, kind of like email addresses or other things, or their age or their sex? Or is that all classified already as non-public?
Chairman Latz and Senator Hall, we really aren't going to ask for much more than their name, their home address, phone number, and email address. Beyond that, the information that's kept isn't on them specifically. It's maybe the programs that they're involved with. We're not going to ask a rental owner, for instance, for the tenants in their building. We're not going to ask a block leader for, you know, their family members' names, addresses, or a block club. We hope that the block leader will take it from there and organize the block so that if they need to know that information, they're in charge of it, and then it's we're not going to be concerned about that, and we'll trust them to cross that bridge when they get to it if there's any concern about their data.
All right,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. One question I had on this bill is this information, if we're protecting the identities of certain people, if that information would result in a prosecution, is that identity lifted then for the purposes of the prosecution?
So if we're prosecuting somebody on this list, or if you're prosecuting?
As a result of information from a protected identity list, if it goes to prosecution, will that identity still be kept private?
Chairman Latz and Senator Limmer, generally the block leaders aren't going to necessarily say, I saw that person do that crime. Probably 99% of what they will say is, you know, there's a lot of traffic to and from this property. Could you look into it? After that, we use all the other tools available to us to determine, okay, yes, they are dealing narcotics, or that's a house of prostitution. And from that point forward, we won't need them to assist in the prosecution because we will have collected whatever else we need. I just really can't imagine that being the case. We have, of course, had block leaders who have been victimized and have to, you know, testify perhaps in court when they've been directly victimized, but they expect that. But that's going to happen in due course if a report is filed. It won't have anything really to do with their information being stored in our system.
All right, seeing no further discussion, anyone else in the room want to testify on this? All right, Senator Dietzick then moves that Senate File 681 as amended be recommended to pass.
Or is it being laid over for further and possible inclusion?
I think what we're going to do. Senator Dietzick, I think what we're going to be doing is sending the individual data practices bills to the floor. And if we do end up putting together an omnibus bill, which I'm not anticipating at this time, but if we do and we need to match up something with the House, then we may incorporate the language from the stuff that we passed onto the floor in that omnibus bill. But just to make sure that the bills keep moving and meet deadline.
Okay.
We'd like to do it this way, if that's okay.
Oh, that's fine.
All right. Then Senator Dietzick moves Senate File 681 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Senator Goodwin, Senate File 509. Senator Goodwin, we're going to have your author's amendment passed out, but while we do that, why don't you go ahead and describe your bill?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Senate File 509 is a bill that clarifies and improves some areas of the Safe at Home program that is a program that comes through the Secretary of State's office to help protect victims of violence, domestic violence, stalking, other issues. That program currently has about 1,200 people in it, and their addresses and everything are protected by having a post office box
that then the Secretary of State's office picks up their mail and forwards it on to them. So now we want to make sure that some municipal utilities and so forth and are also keeping that data private when the victim or the potential victim puts it in writing that they want it to be their data to be private. So and it does a few other things too. And Ms. Claire Wilson is here from the Secretary of State's office, and she can help explain the bill a little further.
Thank you. Before we do that, looks like the A1 author's amendment has been passed out. Senator Goodwin moves adoption of the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Ms. Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Claire Wilson. I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you tonight about our address confidentiality program. I'm always happy to have an opportunity to explain the program a little bit further. And as Senator Goodwin explained, we're here for some technical changes and clarifications in the current statute. So the Safe at Home program is an address confidentiality program for people who fear for their safety. It is a proactive step that people can take to help ensure the safety of themselves and those around them. And it is a tool. It's a program that works for participants in a way that they interact with it and engage with it. And they use the tools that are provided to them in certain ways. And as we walk through the provisions of the bill, you'll see that. Since its inception, the program has served approximately 2,275 people. And as Senator Goodwin said, we currently have approximately 1,250 people enrolled. A majority of those are children. It's 550 households. So the provisions of the bill are processes clarifying some of the current administrative processes of the program. And the goal of the bill is to clarify some of these processes and, in a few instances, to expand some of the protections provided to the families. So Section 1 clarifies persons eligible for enrollment. And in this instance, we are clarifying that to be eligible, you must reside in Minnesota. It's a state-funded program, and that was not currently clarified in law. So it also clarifies that others in the household may also enroll in the program. They don't need to be the primary applicant. This is a way that we're already administering the program. So it makes sense that if you're enrolled and your mom moves in with you, that your mom is then also protected in the program. Like I said, this is something that we're already currently doing. And it does allow application assistants, who are the ones facilitating the enrollment process, a little clarity. Section 2 proposes changes to the actual application. It does clarify that applicants need to provide their full legal name. This is important because applicants will be, through the program, receiving things like their service of process through our office. If that's necessary, we administer voting through the program. So it is necessary that the program has their full legal name. It also clarifies that the others residing in the household can be eligible participants. It does clarify that we always need the physical address, and that in the instance that they don't receive mail at their physical address, we would also need their mailing address. It also allows us in Section 3 to cancel a program participant's enrollment if they do not notify the program of a change in name or address. Or if they become no longer eligible. So, for instance, if they move out of the state, then they're no longer eligible to participate in the program. The amendment before you addresses the general prohibition on the disclosure of the address. And what this essentially does is proposes a general prohibition on the sharing by third parties of a participant's residential address, work address, or school address. And this is primarily to act as a deterrent. To protect the physical address is the primary role of the program. Once that name and address have been disclosed together, it is a safety concern for the participant. And again, people enrolled in this program have taken a rather drastic step to enroll in an address confidentiality program, and they are fearing for their safety in a very fundamental way. So this addresses rare circumstances where someone might have
the name and the physical address. So, for instance, a guardian ad litem, perhaps. And in this instance, the participant will be provided with a form that will allow the third party to know that it is that there is a prohibition on the disclosure of the address. And again, this will be a tool that the participant can utilize if they so choose and allows them some recourse. And again, like I said, primarily should act as a deterrent. And finally, as Senator Goodwin mentioned, with municipal utility data, this clarifies that that data will be classified as private data once the program participant has notified the municipal utility of their enrollment in the program. And that is the general overview.
All right. Are there any questions for members of the committee? Discussion? Any members of the audience wish to be heard on this matter? Seeing none, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 509 as amended be recommended to pass and go to the Senate floor. I will notify members that State and Local Government Committee has indicated they no longer need to hear the bill. So, straight to the floor. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, we have completed the agenda for tonight. We clearly should have put another four or five items on and make use of available time. But as you know, we never know how long some of these bills will take. So let me just make a few planning announcements for the calendars. We will meet on Thursday at noon, as usual, here in Capitol 15. We are going to meet Thursday evening at 6 o'clock, not in this room, though, Capitol 107.
Oh, I don't like 107.
Not anywhere near as high-quality room as this, but Senator Limmer will manage. next week, we will meet, like this week, our regular scheduled times at noon on Tuesday and Thursday and in the evenings Tuesday and Thursday as well, 6 o'clock. And then since next week is a deadline day, March 15th is the first policy deadline, we will meet then. We will start at noon. And frankly, we're just going to go until all the bills that are on the agenda are done so that we leave no bills unattended to that need to meet the first deadline. That's Senator Dietzig.
Sorry. Did you say are we meeting this Friday?
You're not meeting this Friday.
Yay. Thank you.
Why not?
Take your day off.
Senator Latz, just to inform that the Health and Human Services Policy Committee is scheduled to meet at the same times in the evenings. We share the same problem of having more bills than committee time to hear. So Thursday evening is my committee is scheduled at the same time as yours is, and that may happen more than one time, so in order to meet these deadlines. So you'll know where I am, and if you need me, I can. I'm having trouble getting my committee to all come because they have other conflicts too, so I will share a common problem here of trying to get enough people to get our work through. So I don't know how free I'd be able to come and go.
Are you meeting Friday the 15th as well?
Yes.
Well, I guess we'll do the best that we can.
And let me just check and make sure and tell you.
Perhaps if it becomes an issue for a second deadline, we can try to coordinate which evenings we meet so that at least we don't overlap.
Well, excuse me.
Anyway, we'll
work it out. I'm double booked on the 15th, too.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and try to work out the scheduling separately. But there being no further business to come before the committee, at this time, we are adjourned.
Thank you.